Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Last night, Hillary Clinton did an interview about her new book on Rachel Maddow's show on MSNBC. No surprise there. But when it was over, here's the part that Rachel singled out as the most newsworthy. It wasn't Hillary talking about Trump, or Hillary talking about James Comey, or Hillary talking about Bernie Sanders and the Bernie Bros. It was Hillary talking about Facebook.
I mean, transparency would be the best way of undermining Putin. We now know that they were sowing discord during the election with phony groups on Facebook. They were running anti-immigrant, anti-me, anti-Hillary Clinton demonstrations. They were, you know, putting out all this fake news, all these negative stories that were untrue to really divide people. So if your government were to say, you know what, we're going to get to the bottom of this, and we're not, look, we may have our disagreements among Americans, mm-hmm. we're not going to let the Russians come in and divide us. And so we're going to make Facebook own up to everything. They've just begun to own up. They have a long way to go before they get to where they need to be, in my opinion. Other tech companies, we're going to go after these provocateurs, these Russians posing as Americans, these content farms in Macedonia, these thousand trolls, these tens of thousands of bots. Because you know what? We have every right to have a vigorous debate in America, but we don't want it being interfered with and suborned by Putin and his allies.
Hillary Clinton last night, the night before on Rachel Maddow, Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat in the Senate Intelligence Committee's Russia investigation, unloaded on Facebook, too, after Facebook testimony to his committee that he found disturbingly incomplete.
They came in and made a presentation, said there was $100,000 plus of paid advertising. There were 3,000 plus ads purchased. And in that presentation, they showed the staff certain of those ads, but they didn't allow the staff to keep any of that material. And I went back, I figured you'd ask this question, mm-hmm. and to my knowledge, they made no reference to this effort to try to bring about protesters to an anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant rally. It's why I think that we're still at the tip of the iceberg. But the fact is, I don't think Facebook has put the resources, the time, and I think there's a lot more. They've discovered one of the troll farms that came out of St. Petersburg. My understanding is they didn't even go back and check all those accounts to see if they had put out other ads.
Senator Mark Warner. So what's this all about? Well, the Daily Beast reports that Facebook refuses to commit to releasing Kremlin-backed propaganda that it uncovered. That includes not only fake news stories that could have reached 70 million Americans, but also, as Hillary Clinton referred to briefly, in-person activities like organizing anti-Muslim rallies, apparently to help the Trump campaign and hurt Clinton and sow discord in the United States in general. There's no indication from what's been revealed so far of collusion between the Trump campaign and these Russia trolls, but the point is, Facebook is withholding a lot of stuff. And this is just one of several developments this week in the Russia investigation, flying a little below the news media radar with the hurricanes and Trump starting to do deals with the Democrats. So let's catch up. The Daily Beast has been leading the pack on the Facebook story. So we're joined by Spencer Ackerman, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast, who's been writing these articles, and Josh Dawsey, White House correspondent for Politico. He has the view from there and on some of the other developments. Thanks for coming on, Spencer. Thanks, Josh. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks very much.
Spencer, walk us through this a little bit for people who haven't been watching this closely. What's been emerging about Facebook's role in Russia trolling the election?
So, first off, a week ago, after a tremendous amount of pressure and interest and speculation and partial reporting, Facebook reversed its earlier position from the summer that it was able to find no indication that Russian propaganda had paid its way onto its platform, and revealed that something on the order of $100,000 worth of ad purchases connected to about 470 inauthentic accounts hosted information, promoted information, paid to promote information, concerning really just inflammatory, divisive messages aimed at the American public. And some of these are found from things like IP addresses that are in the United States, but the language settings are set to Russian, for instance. They found these to be connected to a kind of paid troll farm in St. Petersburg, and continued to kind of sort of slow walk new information out. But among the things they didn't include were what was the reach of that of that paid propaganda and so forth. And we were able to determine, based on talking with people who had some knowledge of the way Facebook's ad platform works, that it would have reached something between, as a conservative estimate, 23 million and 70 million people. So a real tremendous amount of reach for not a whole lot of money. Then we talked with Facebook to try and figure out things like what specifically did they have in terms of data integrity assurances when they were working with the Trump campaign. So basically, Facebook contributes, as they will to any campaign, some help to the Trump campaign and its allies ahead of the 2016 election for targeting voters. And there are real questions that congressional investigators and also the Mueller team are going to have about the authenticity of that data, both as the pipeline to the Trump campaign as the pipeline from the Trump campaign. Because as The Intercept and others have reported, there are real questions about voter roll data being exfiltrated ahead of the 2016 election. So Facebook's answer, when we ask them for any of this information, if they've looked at it, if they've presented material to Congress, if we can see it, is that we're not going to make any more information public, at least right now. They won't commit, for instance, to, even after they're finished with their internal review about their role and their platform's role in the 2016 election, making a version of that public. We went to some of the congressional leaders of the investigations, because Facebook's rationale for not making it public is we have to prioritize the investigations, and those legislators told us that they back, in some form at some appropriate time, a public release. But right now, there's quite an extensive horizon of information relevant to what exactly happened with Facebook, Russia, propaganda in the 2016 campaign that the social media giant is basically saying you ought not to see.
Now, listeners, our lines are open if you want to ask Josh Dawsey, White House correspondent for Politico, a question about anything White House or the White House reaction to the Facebook story or anything else Russia investigation related, or Spencer Ackerman, who was just talking, national security correspondent for The Daily Beast, who's been writing these articles about what Facebook was used to do during the election, what Facebook will and won't tell the public about that, etc. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9696. And Josh, be patient for a minute. I want to walk through a little bit more of this with Spencer. Spencer, what's this line that the Russians crossed using Facebook from fake news to in-person organizing?
So it's an excellent question, and it's something that Facebook's initial statement last week did not actually include. We looked into, thanks to, you know, cached material from some of the accounts that Facebook took down, what exactly that propaganda was. Because, again, Facebook isn't sharing that. You, from the clip you played, they didn't even share that with the Senate investigation. And some of the stuff that we found were advertisements using, or rather were event notices using Facebook's event function for in-person rallies that hosted really just kind of shocking amounts of hate directed at immigrants and at Muslims. It didn't mention any candidate. It wasn't geared specifically as a political rally. It was geared kind of as an issue rally. And it took place, or, you know, said to have taken place, this one we found in particular, this town of Twin Falls, Idaho, that was kind of the center of a lot of fake news about, for instance, a tuberculosis scare, a tuberculosis increase supposedly due to refugees. That's fake news. It didn't happen. Nevertheless, what we were able to find from this indication was that the propaganda in question went from just spreading material online to trying to get Americans who think they are seeing information from other Americans and certainly think that they are seeing genuine or verified information, have no reason to believe otherwise, to get them to do something physical, to get them to do something outside of an online space and participate in a rally in the United States.
And how does an anti-immigrant rally in Twin Falls, Idaho, not a swing state, help Trump or help Russia?
It's sort of the way, or at least the theory would go, that it spreads social division, the kind of wedge stuff that a foreign adversary can exploit. It might not be specific to, you know, as you say, helping Trump in a state that he's going to carry no matter what, but it kind of, just as this one example, there are surely others that we don't know of yet because Facebook won't tell us, in which the atmosphere contributes to a kind of bubbling anger about the sort of things that Trump is encouraging and Russia encouraging Americans to be angry about.
So Josh Dawsey, White House correspondent for Politico, any reaction from the White House or Trump World defense lawyers on any of this Facebook stuff? Are they downplaying it? Are they not expressing concern about the implications for our democracy because in these cases it helped Trump? Or is there any reaction from the White House?
We haven't had any reaction from the White House yet, Brian, but we have seen interest in having Brad Parscale, who is the digital director of the campaign, testify. And I think the White House and at least campaign veterans that I talk to, you know, expect that this will be a line of inquiry for some time. You know, they have denied pretty vociferously having anything to do with foreign collusion and working with groups like this. But I think time will tell, as Spencer is saying on air. We've heard a lot of denials that have not necessarily proven to be true.
Spencer, is it illegal for Facebook to take presidential campaign-related advertising money from Russians if they're not officially from the Russian government?
I don't honestly know the answer to that question. I'm a national security reporter, and I wish I knew. It's an excellent question. I can't, in good conscience, offer an answer for you. I'm sorry.
Well, Facebook told the Daily Beast that they're not well-placed to know if something like coordination took place between the Trump campaign and Russia. Do you take that at face value?
No, not at all. Facebook is probably one of the entities best positioned on Earth to know that, because they would have in their servers extensive data about how, for instance, if it is the case that Russian propaganda peanut butter mixed with Trump campaign chocolate, it won't tell you everything, but it will tell you a substantial amount and will do so in you know, minute and rather hard data detail.
And
so it was... I can tell you, greeted with a kind of stunned silence initially when my colleague and I were talking with Facebook and we got that stance. It's something that very few people take to be credible, and I'm sure the investigations are going to look at that extensively, and we'll see if that's a denial, that's a position from Facebook that stands the test of time.
And I'm curious, why do you think Facebook is being so withholding? Why would Facebook have an interest in keeping Russian trolling secret?
I think, you know, one obvious case that comes to mind is that they don't simply want to be known as a platform that can be manipulated. It invites a lot of government intrusion and speculation about potential regulation, about a company that doesn't really fundamentally think of itself as a media company, doesn't fundamentally think of itself as a publisher, but thinks of itself as a platform, and one that's grown tremendously over the years, pretty much without a presumption that it has a lot of implication, certainly from a regulatory position, as a vector of political speech, even though it's pretty clear that it's a central vector of political speech in this day and age.
We're talking about new developments in the Russia investigation with Spencer Ackerman from The Daily Beast, who's been reporting on Facebook-related developments, and Josh Dawsey, White House correspondent for Politico, and Harry in Norris, Tennessee. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling, Harry.
Well, thank you for your program. I've been down here 9 years. I'm an ex-New Yorker, so that's why I love your program.
You know, you're starting to acquire the accent. You know that.
the question I have is, I mean, this is sort of fiction come to reality, but the question I have is there any connection to Bannon and Mercer in connection with and also in connection to the Brexit vote? Were they trolling around the Brexit vote, and was that a model that was useful for them, and did they then follow through with this technique? Because it seems Breitbart lives in that kind of world of conjuring up AstroTurf groups and all kinds of things, and Mercer seems to also be in this kind of nebulous world.
Spencer, any Bannon collusion, connection, conspiracy, any word that starts with C-O-N?
So the Mercer family funds the Cambridge Analytica firm, the data mining firm that worked and voter targeting firm that worked with the Trump campaign, and certainly worked extensively on Facebook. I think we're still kind of at the position of viewing that as hypothesis rather than proven fact. There's a lot of there's a lot of data that has yet to emerge, a lot of evidence that's yet to emerge before we are responsibly equipped to actually draw ties from each of the different things that the caller is talking about yet. But it's definitely going to be a line of inquiry.
Josh Dawsey, I just want to read a tweet that we got from a listener before we slightly change topics here with you. Somebody named Kate writes, Brian Lehrer plus Josh Dawsey equals a better Friday morning than I expected. So there you go, before you've even gotten to say very much. Before we go on to Michael Flynn aspects of this and some other things, Jared Kushner, revelation from the Wall Street Journal and more, anything you want to say just from your perspective as an observer of all things in this area about the Facebook connections? You don't have to, but I'm just curious if you're sitting there thinking anything.
The only thing I'm thinking is that, the White House is expecting the grand jury testimony in the Russia probe to heat up in the next couple of months. We're seeing that. Paul Manafort's people are testifying today. From everything we're hearing, new subpoenas are arriving, to campaign folks, to White House aides, to, everyone. And I think the biggest concern folks in the White House that I talk to have are things maybe a little bit outside of his Facebook world, different things that happened in the White House with the Comey firing and the cover-up, what Paul Manafort was up to, what Mike Flynn was up to. And I think what, Spencer's reported about Facebook, I think is going to be a very interesting line of inquiry. But we're seeing kind of a scope of this grow more and more by the day. A special counsel that was originally impaneled to do a certain thing, I think has a number of veins that they're looking at that has tentacles all across the Trump orbit and campaign and White House.
Who's testifying today related to Manafort, and is that in public?
Yeah, no, Paul Manafort's spokesman is testifying in front of a federal grand jury today. They took a pretty unusual and aggressive step of subpoenaing a spokesperson for a person under investigation into mandatory under oath grand jury testimony. So it kind of shows that the Manafort line is accelerating in recent weeks.
The Wall Street Journal this week reported that members of the president's legal team have recommended that Jared Kushner resign from his government position because he faces increasing legal liability. What is Kushner's potential legal liability believed to be, and why would it be increasing?
Well, Kushner has challenges on several fronts. He, amended his SF-86 security clearance form on several occasions to note more than 100 undisclosed contacts with foreign officials that he previously didn't delineate. He also was present and integral in several critical decisions, including the statement on Air Force One that was written that kind of was a misleading statement about a Trump Tower meeting last summer between Russians and campaign officials, and he was integral in the decision to fire James Comey at Bedminster. Plus, you have some questions about Jared Kushner's business dealings in New York, 666 the big Manhattan skyscraper that his company and his father have put together. So I think for Kushner, the concerns that the lawyers had at the time were, A, could he even get a security clearance? B, having a family member in the White House with this many different problems, did it open the president up to a lot of new lines of inquiry? And I think, you know, the conversations that the president was having frequently with Mr. Kushner at the time were not privileged and were not protected from a lawyer from prosecutors looking into it. So there was some concern there as well because, Jared Kushner was making a lot of these decisions while he was involved in a lot of these different matters himself and did not have the kind of attorney-client privilege that Mark Kasowitz, attorney at the time, had.
Another development this week reported by NBC News is that Michael Flynn's son, Michael Flynn Jr., is now a subject of Robert Mueller's investigation. Why might Flynn Jr. be a subject, and what would the significance be of that ultimately for the president?
Well, Flynn Jr. was integral at the Flynn Intelligence Group, where his father worked as well. And both of these men have some issues from private clients that they had before the presidential transition and before the White House, working with Turkish-affiliated groups, working with folks who wanted to build nuclear power plants across the Middle East. A lot of different people relied on the Flynn Intelligence Group, for services and consulting. And I think what Mueller's team is zeroing in on is what favors Flynn and his son tried to do on the transition, how they tried to help people, whether they disclosed, whether they, properly recused themselves. Essentially, what actions were they taking during the transition for Flynn Jr., who never made it into the White House? It's not a matter of official government service, but for his dad, official government service too. What actions did they take, and who were they really serving? And I think that has them both in the crosshairs of Mr. Mueller.
Yeah, Flynn Sr. seems to be in really deep mud with a growing list of contacts with Russia-related and other foreign entities that he was even getting paid for in some cases through this business that he failed to disclose on his security clearance forms for becoming national security advisor, at least if all this reporting is true. So are there any implications from Flynn's mounting troubles for Donald Trump?
That's a million-dollar question, Brian. We've seen an aggressive effort by the special counsel to, flip Paul Manafort, to approach his son-in-law, to push him to kind of become a witness and to tell everything they know. And our sense is that, Mr. Mueller's team would also like to do that for Mr. Flynn, or would at least be interested in hearing what else he has to say about various matters. Unlike Mr. Manafort, Mr. Flynn was in the White House for 24 days. He had the meeting with Russian officials during the transition. He was privy to all sorts of national security conversations. He was privy on the trail to conversations with donors and lobbyists and, everyone else kind of involved in this confusing puzzle that we're all trying to untangle. So for Flynn, I think there's a lot more liability for the president than there is, for Manafort or maybe another one of the figures in this. Also, you've seen the president, continually express support for Michael Flynn. He even sent him a message after he was fired or he resigned saying, hang tough, hang tight. So you're certainly seeing some conflicting signals on, how much the White House wants to distance themselves, but also, trying to keep close ties to Michael Flynn.
Rob in Roslyn, you're on WNYC with Josh Dawsey from Politico and Spencer Ackerman from The Daily Beast. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Brian, longtime listener. So I contend that spending $100,000 on Facebook doesn't really buy you much in the internet world. And this is why I suggest that, is because, first of all, advertising is much like pollution for a lot of people. I don't know about you, but I tend to ignore a lot of the ads that are on my computer or on my phone because it's just kind of like noise. And then for the folks that that do look at ads, I think those numbers, I think it was 20 million or so was the number of people purported to have been affected. Those numbers are grossly overestimated because there's a whole fraudulent click fraud industry, which basically, there are these click fraud farms that will click on ads. They're basically robots.
Right. So Facebook or whatever the other media outlet is can charge more for the ads because they say, look how many people are seeing your stuff, right?
Exactly, Brian. And Google just had to refund a bunch of money to advertisers for exactly that reason. So, you know,
your point is whatever this was probably didn't influence the outcome of the election very much.
Exactly. Well said.
Rob, thank you. So I'm glad he asked that question because it's a good question. And also, Spencer, because one of your articles I really love for how it gave us a glimpse into how advertising works on Facebook as a social media site, as opposed to, say, buying an old-fashioned TV commercial, like how little money it takes to try to get an idea to go viral on social media and how precisely targeted the boosting of that message can be by geography or other things. So in response to Rob and for everybody's edification, can you describe some of that?
Well, I would just say that the margin is enormous because we're talking about a vast, vast, vast amount of reach for not a whole lot of money. So let's say that you are someone who tends to kind of tune out ads. Maybe that certainly works for you, but it's not going to be the case for a lot of people. And when we're looking at what the margins in this election were, it wouldn't be definitive that, but for Facebook, but for this propaganda, there would be a different president in office. Nevertheless, it looks quite a lot like you don't really need to put in a lot to leverage a tremendous amount of visibility, and at least some of that is going to be, in kind of the backgrounds of people's brains. And, this is a company that builds ads and sells ads for basically like one reason that others can't really match, with the exception of Google, which is that the reason why it can target as specifically as it does and with the reach that it has is because it has data from 2 billion people. It has incredibly granular data from every Facebook customer that uses this platform. And from there, you can get extremely specific about who sees what.
You do report that most of the geo-targeting in these Russia posts was in 2015. Does that mean there were more to help Trump in the primaries than the general election?
Well, so here's where Facebook really has to tell more about what that geo-targeting was. All we really know from that, all I was going off of from that, is what Facebook's chief security officer, Alex Stamos, put out publicly last week, which is that the as you say, the overwhelming, or I don't even know if it's overwhelming, I shouldn't even use that word, most of the geo-targeting that it's saying it saw connected to these accounts took place in 2015. What he didn't say is where that took place. It didn't say what in 2016 the geotargeting looked like and how it changed over time. So it's at this point, a hypothesis that it might have been to help Trump in the primaries, or it might have been to like activate some of his voters or get them, sort of super riled up to take part in a process that, perhaps they might not have, or perhaps they might have chosen a different candidate for until like they start, having these messages pumped before them. It's something that I can't answer, and really only Facebook can. And right now they're saying they won't answer it.
Yeah. And in terms of the ultimate effect on the election, I mean, the general election, as we all know, is very close, just that tiny percentage of votes in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Do you have any estimate? Do you think, Nate Silver or anyone would have any way of estimating from any of your reporting how decisive Russia's role may have been, and maybe it's diminished by the fact that a lot of this trolling came in 2015 that early? How many votes all this Facebook exposure plus its Democratic Party email hack and dissemination by the Russians may have been worth?
Sorry, that was to me?
Yes, it is.
Sorry, I misunderstood. I don't know. I mean, this is still a tremendous amount of it's Facebook basically last week and throughout this week has baked us a donut. And the answers that we're all looking for are in the hole. And we've got to figure out at what point sufficient, whether it's investigation into, internally what Facebook's role was here or external pressure from the legislators and investigators that it's dealing with in the federal government to ultimately compel Facebook to say more publicly. And, we just don't know yet.
Josh, while you're here, And we're almost out of time, but we'll be talking to Senator Gillibrand in about a half hour about several things, including the confusing state of whether Trump has an immigration deal brewing with the Democrats, some version of allowing the young adult DACA recipients to stay in exchange for more border security, but not including a wall per se. But is it a real deal or a fake deal?
It depends who you ask and what time of the day you ask them. I think Senator Schumer and Congresswoman Pelosi left on Wednesday night believing there was a real deal. President Trump tweeted Thursday morning that there wasn't a deal, and then he seemed to outline parts of a deal. I think this, Senator Schumer still thinks that there was a good possibility for a deal, but the conservative backlash on this to the president has been pretty furious. You've seen him tweet several times this morning some pretty hardline immigration stances, talking about a tougher travel ban even. So you have a president who I think wants to make a deal here, who thinks he's in a tough spot and can hopefully work with Democrats on this. But among his base and among a lot of his supporters, this has been one of the biggest concerns yet with his presidency. It's been a cascade of criticism from the right.
Let me play an example of that. A rare Ann Coulter shot at Trump on WBAL radio in Baltimore.
You know, he's like a couch. He picks up whatever the person sitting on him is wearing. that was obviously concerning.
And Breitbart took a rare shot at Trump, too. They posted a headline that called Trump Amnesty Don. So how do you understand the big picture of what Trump might be doing here? His whole presidency so far, in political terms, has been playing to his nationalist base. Is that changing as a matter of intent?
Well, it appears to have been changing in the past 10 days. You've seen a pretty hard right presidency that was fueled by Steve Bannon and other members of kind of that coterie of aides that went pretty full force for 7 months. I think the president has gone frustrated with the inability of Republicans on the Hill to pass any major legislation, particularly health care. He thinks tax reform is not moving quickly enough, wants to get infrastructure done this fall. And I think he has become kind of disenchanted with Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and saying, let's try something new. He also has a kind of a personal rapport with Chuck Schumer. Both of them are from New York. Schumer was caught on a hot mic yesterday saying he likes me. That's why he's working with me. So it seems that at least for the past 10 days, he's taken a very different approach to governing. That said, Brian, I think there's going to be some substantive chasms that are going to be really tough to get past in the next 6 months. And a lot of these big-ticket issues, the parties are so diametrically opposed that I can't imagine kind of these kumbaya moments, these White House dinners, these phone calls are going to lead to any sort of real legislation, at least on a number of fronts.
Well, we'll follow it closely. We'll get a reaction from Senator Gillibrand in a half hour. Final thing, and Spencer, it's for you, from a listener posting a question on Twitter. The question is, as a Facebook user, this person writes, what action can be taken to hold them accountable for this complicity in the sowing of division and hate?
That's an excellent question. I wish I knew the answer. I don't really know. I wish I could give something either effective or reassuring. I don't know. Post something to your Facebook account, calling for Facebook to say more. I guess I don't really know. I don't really know that it's the job of journalists to provide activist advice. You know.
And if it's the job of journalists to provide a lot of good information from a lot of digging, Spencer Ackerman has done his job as senior national security correspondent for The Daily Beast, who's been writing these articles about Facebook and the Russia investigation. And Josh Dawsey has been with us, White House correspondent for Politico. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.